from this working party that we went on the death march. Now this was in 1944 towards the end of the war. 44. Beginning of 45, January was the date. 24th of January, 1945. We started on this death march, and it was very cold. We were in Poland at the time. At first, we made wooden sledges out of lots of old timber we could get from anywhere. Big sledges, not to carry all our bits of gear and our sick men. And we had a long shaft in the front with half a dozen ropes. And we would walk in front and pull on the ropes and hold the shaft. This was quite easy, really, whilst the ice was frozen. We used to take it in turns to pull, say, a dozen at a time, and the carts or sledges would slide over the snow, no bother at all. When we first started the march, at once I thought, well, I'll try to escape straight away before we go. But then I thought it over and I said to myself, whilst the Russians are advancing behind us and we are moving forward to our own front, we can't do much else but stay with the prisoners as we're going the right direction. We marched and marched for months, literally months. No one'd sleep at night. Just at hot times, we'd find a very large farm, Dominion as they called it. But no food, just odd bits of food here and there, wherever we could get it. After being a prisoner for nearly 5 years, we'd been on working parties, not direct course passes at times. So we tried to keep ourselves clean and fit. So you can understand, as thousands of those prisoners started out reasonably fit on that march, also thousands died on that march through malnutrition, through sickness, through accidents, and through death being killed by the Germans just because we wouldn't do what they wanted at the moment. Our very first stop was in a brickyard. I'll never forget this, because they put us on the bottom floor, our working party and several others that had accumulated on the way. We also picked up some Russians, and they put those on the top floor. The top floor was one big floor of steel mesh with holes in it, steel grating. And in the night, the Germans wouldn't let us out to urinate or things like that. But during the night, we discovered the Russians were the same as ourselves, and they started urinating down the walls and between the grids. And it seemed to us from then on that it was raining all night. They just did it on us all night long. This is humorous, but maddening at the time, you can imagine. We marched and marched. across fields, woods and tracks and roads, frozen ice. Our boots are frozen stiff on our feet again, as I've said before, with the frost thick on our clothes where we were breathing on them. And as the weeks and months went on, men were becoming exhausted and would lie down to die in the snow. Sometimes the guards would pick them up and push them forward with butts of rifles. Other times, when they were too exhausted, the guards would leave them where they were and wait until the column had gone by and stick bayonets in their hearts to finish them. This I've seen done. I've been at the end of the column at times, a very dangerous place to be, of course, but this is where you see it done. And the idea was, it was quieter and easier to leave them to the end of the column and stick a bayonet in them than shoot them. And it caused disturbance with the prisoners. The more we marched, the longer we marched, the more prisoners we picked up on the way, until we had literally thousands, columns of them, sneaking away in the snow in the distance. And when our sledges would break down, we would carry what bit of kit we could, or throw it away, and any man which were too sick to push along or walk along, we had to leave at the sides of the roads. Not knowing their fate, of course. Before we started this march, I knew a lot of very fit men, but by the end, they were very sick men. I would say that 75% at one time or other had dysentery. And again, this is where I seriously got dysentery. I remember stopping at a big farm one time, and all the prisoners just piled in and slept anywhere. But for some reason, they kept us there for a few weeks. And everyone got dysentery, very little food. And all night long, men were running outside in the snow to relieve themselves. But when you've had no food, after so long, there's no more in your bowels to pass. And I remember seeing men pass blood and white slime and still go on and on trying and trying until they got weaker and weaker. And the bowels, their bowel, the lining of their bowels and the bleeding was weakening them so much. Lying in the snow with their trousers down, freezing. I had a pal at the last working party at Dershowm, Australian, called Cyril Bailey from Melbourne. He was about 18 stone when he started, big man, boxer, tough man. I lost track of him on the way, but about 6 weeks later, I was going out to the toilet and I saw a row of men huddled up in some straw, and one of these men was Cyril Bailey. He was down to about 8 stone, maybe less. He was a big man with a big chest, and his breast hung down to his waist, the skin of his breast, and there was no meat there at all. It was the most pitying sight to see such a fit, big, strong man in that position. Since this war, I've been to Australia, but it wasn't possible for me to look him up at that time. I wish I had done now. Maybe I will one day. At one period, I got really depressed and fed up. And although I'd been a prisoner almost 5 years, I thought, there's no point in going on. And the German tanks were rushing back from the Russian front, rolling back in their hundreds, passing us all the time. And I used to think, I'll jump under one of these tanks and finish my life, because I can't stand no more. But the tank would roll by, and later another one would come by, and I would say to myself, under this one, van. But no, I thought this for a long time. But I was strong too, I had some guts. I just kept going. I never ever mentioned this to anyone. Never. And no one ever mentioned such things to me at that time. But now I wonder how many other men thought the same. Must have been thousands. One other time when we stopped at a farm, there was a cellar with some potatoes in. And the guards used to issue them out, and we'd have to eat them the best we could, or cook them, or however we could. But the guards suddenly discovered that these potatoes were going down very quick. And there was a little hole at one end, like a little vent. And they said, well, whoever it is must be coming through this vent. So they waited one night and trained a rifle on the hole. And a man came through head first. It's the only way he could get through. And I just blew his brains out. His brains actually came out the hole, and some of it fell at my feet. Was it worth it? I wonder. As we were marching along, we used to come across potato clamps in the fields. And I've seen men all around the bottom, trying to dig a hole in them. They were frozen, they couldn't do it. But they were trying. And the guards used to say, come back, come back, because we'll shoot you. And the men used to stay there and defy the guns, hoping they'd get a potato and get away. No, I nearly got shot. I always resisted these sort of things. The same as when men used to eat any kind of food. I used to try and resist eating anything until I knew it was fit. Because I used to say, if you eat poison food, you'll die at once, perhaps. Where you may exist some time. Malnutrition, starvation, and then survive, which I did. But at one time, towards the end of this march, this is a bit previous, of course, but I'm thinking of it right now, when all the guard deserted us after the 8th of May, the end of the war, we got into a cellar, or like a laboratory, and all around the walls were jars of white meat, like in pickle. In a white solution. And before we thought of what it might be, we got them down and ate them. And I'll never forget to this day, I ate some of this too. And I felt very bad after. And then it dawned on me, I have no proof of this, but in my mind I'm almost certain, that this was a experimental laboratory. And to this day, I think the meat in these jars was human remains. Experimental jars. I remember another time we came to a farm. And there was a big old sow with about 12 little young ones. And in the morning, there was nothing left. I wasn't fortunate enough to have any of it, but it was laughable, even at that time. Humorous bit. When the guards left us at the end of the war, half a dozen of us went into a barn to get some sleep and rest. I found a German sergeant, army sergeant, in there. And of course he thought we would kill him, but we didn't. We had never had that in mind at all. But he must have had a loaf of bread hidden somewhere, because all of a sudden he started crying. Oh, where's my bread? Where's my bread? Where's my bread? Someone's stolen it. At the same time, the very next day, as a matter of fact, we all went to search for some food, because we had no guards then, you see. And at this time we were in Czechoslovakia. We'd been crossing Czechoslovakia for quite some time. And we came across a convoy, a food convoy, which had broken down and been left. And again, a humorous bit sticks out of my memory, very much so. There was political refugees, German refugees, German soldiers, British prisoners, and all other kinds of prisoners, like Russian, fighting over the food on the wagon. I managed to pinch a big box of something, and when I got it away, it was a box of sweets, which wasn't very good to me. But I actually saw one German in uniform, two prisoners, and two civilians, all pulling at a side of bacon, all trying to tear away from each other. And even then, I'm sure I must have smiled. All these months and weeks we've been marching, the Russians have been getting closer and closer, and you can hear their guns in the distance every day and every night. And the object of marching us like this is to keep us in front of the Russian lines so that we will not be retaken. We are not marching in a straight line, as you can imagine, not once. Just but moving like a spearhead, from left to right, forward, right, forward, left, just to keep ahead of the Russians. And although at this time I was so miserable and hungry and dirty, I still had time to admire the beauty around me. Because we went through some beautiful forest, saw some beautiful hills and dales and valleys and castles, and as we were passing. At the end of the war, I was very near Prague, just a few days from Prague. And I remember going into Prague after the war and sleeping a couple of nights. I went to the Czechoslovakian local authorities, to a big hall there, to get a paper so that I could move about freely. I kept that for a long time, but I lost it in the end somewhere. It authorized me to move about as a free person until such times as I could go home. But there was no food and nowhere really to stay in Prague. So we went on our way to try and reach the American lines or the British lines. But the Russians reached us first. And we thought, well, at least we'll get some food and some shelter and probably some transport back to our own lines. But this was pretty general, what I'm going to tell you now. And whenever prisoners went to the Russian authorities and asked for food and transport, help, they would say, we don't want to know you. Find your way to your own lines. We do not recognize prisoners of war. And this went for their own prisoners as well. This amazed me at that time. I was very lucky. I asked a Russian for some food one night. See, me and my pal, half a dozen of us, well, maybe there was thousands or more as well, but I'm talking of my little group. We found ourselves marching through a town, and we were actually marching with the Russian frontline soldiers. As they were advancing, they'd caught us up, and we were marching with them. One said to me, come down this lane a minute. We'll get you something to eat. We understood this one way or the other. But when I went down this lane, I was trailing behind with my mate. And these Russians were drunk. And when we got there, there was one shot on the floor. And they're all laughing and giggling. They shot one of their own mates. Apparently white Russians and Mongolians don't like each other or something. So I said to my pal, come on, let's get out. And we doubled back and disappeared. And all they could do, these Russians, were to rape the women, loot and plunder all they could. I'm not prejudiced, because I think today the Russians more culture than they had done in those days, and a very much more advanced country. But at this time was very surprised. After a few days of walking, trying to get bits of food, everyone was commandeering transport wherever they could. So I took a bicycle off a German, decided to ride on a bike, but I got a puncture after a little while. So although I didn't believe in this sort of thing, I still had to change this bike for another one. So I took another one off another German and gave him the old one with a puncture. This was my survival as well as his. I went into a village and saw two British soldiers on a motorbike, riding up and down the village street, like cowboys, firing guns. I thought, you bloody fool. I met a German with a armored car, and I asked him for his car. I said, the war is over, give me a gun. He would not give me the gun or the car, and said, I will not give it up. I said, it's no good to you now. The war is over. I won't harm you. And he also said, I won't harm you either, but you're not getting my gun. So, being a sensible chap, I left him and went on my way. I think I did right. Myself and another chap went cycling on. We cycled for a few days, moved around, didn't really know where we were going. We knew we were going to our lines or the American lines. I lost my pal on the way. I think I was a bit stronger than him. I just kept cycling, and he must have dropped out. So in the end, I was on my own, I came into O'Neill's place called Ager and stopped at the side of the road for a rest. And then another prisoner came along the road on a bicycle, same as myself. He stopped and we had a chat. And the next vehicle to come along was an American Jeep with about two Americans in it, three Americans, by what night lab. We just left the bikes, jumped in the back of the Jeep, and they took us back to some place in Ager, and we had a bed and all the food we wanted for one day. And the next day, the Americans transported us to a place called Regensburg. And the next morning, we flew home from there, or rather to France. I don't know where in France now, I'm sorry. Then from France, one night there, and flew home the next day to Oxfordshire. A reception at the airfield, but alas, I wasn't well after the flight and I couldn't eat nothing. I felt bad, so I decided to go into hospital there. But when all my friends were changed and cleaned up and on their way home, I thought, no, no matter how bad you are, you must go home too. So I discharged myself. One of the best things I ever heard in my life was when I was traveling from the airfield to a bus stop about 5 miles away. And from the back of the truck, I could hear English voices, children playing in the street and speaking English again. It was wonderful. I'll never forget it. Then I went back to Bristol, went on leave, had a long leave, with some money to spend, but I still wasn't really happy. I really had no family to go to. And I was stationed in Yorkshire. Then I went to Blackpool for a while. That's where I met my wife. Married, came back to Bristol. I was still on regular reserve at this time. After being married for about 4.5 years and settling down in Civvy Street, had a little daughter, Margaret. I got recalled to the colors for service in Korea. I went and I did a year and a half in Korea with my old regiment, Glorious Gloucesters. I was at the Imjin battle. I will talk more of this later. We're pretty poor in these days, but I always saved up anything I wanted, and everything I had was my own, paid for. Wasn't a lot, but it was paid for. So when I got recalled to the forces, I put in for a grant to help my wife along whilst out of the way. Because my army pay was, in those days, but below my wage I earned as a bricklayer. Anyway, they allowed me 2 and 6 months a week. I wrote back to the War Office records and told them they could keep their 2 and 6 months. They wrote back and said they had reviewed it and they would allow me 4 and 6 months. So I accepted it. Better than nothing. I arrived in Korea. I'll never forget the morning I came up on deck. I think it was the 11th of November. and the snow on the hills, and cold, again, very cold. After being there for a period, I had a proficiency rise of 3 6d. So the War Office records wrote to me and told me that they were stopping the 3 6d out of my 4 6d. That left me with a shilling grant to spend 18 months in Korea under all trying conditions. And again, I was very lucky there. I was as near dead 4 times, I would say. But I wasn't killed. I was lucky. And once again, I was almost taken prisoner. There were men taken prisoner there that were prisoner of war with me for 5 years in Europe in the Second World War. They did a further 2.5 years in Korean prison war camps, making 7.5 years in total of their life in prisoner of war camps. I remember when arriving at Busan, the band was there to see us in, the American band and the small Korean band, and all the Korean girls with garlands of flowers. I don't know who they thought we were, but that's how they greeted us. We boarded trains at the docks.